This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. And check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes back Brooks Long to discuss David Ritz's biography of CBS Records boss Walter Yetnikoff. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
Time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and tonight we're welcoming back Brooks Long to continue the David Ritz Book Club with a look at Walter Yetnikoff's Howling at the Moon, The Odyssey of a Monstrous Music Mogul in an Age of Excess. Brooks, does it live up to the title?
I'd have to say so. From what I'm seeing here, he left out some things that would really contribute to the title as well.
Indeed. There's a couple things that are mentioned in the book, but way underplayed.
Sure.
Like the casual reference to how he got the royalty rate for CDs reduced by 50% because of, quote, manufacturing costs, which I guess because CDs are so much cheaper to manufacture than vinyl,
there's a lot that he threw in the last like 10 pages of that book that one could come away with a lot of questions just from those last 10 pages.
And for those of you who are going, who the heck is Walter Yetnikoff? The man was the president of CBS Music from the early 1970s until the early 1990s. He presided over a transition from the age of the record man to the corporate age we've been living in since the mid-90s. He's a very interesting transitional figure and not entirely awful.
No. Comparatively, he seems like the sort of person that big stars could trust. You know, at the beginning of the book, he talks about getting a call from Billy Joel, who thanked him for letting him know that, what was it, his brother-in-law or something was screwing him over.
His managers, I believe.
Yeah. Well,
And I believe he actually bought Billy Joel's publishing back and gave it to Billy Joel. Although that I didn't either. I found that somewhere else, but I couldn't find it in the book when I went back looking for that. So, yeah, sometimes he did nice things. And he seems like he was definitely a charming individual. But the other book that he's frequently mentioned in is Frederick Dannon's Hitman, which was a spectacular publishing event in the early 90s, because that really reveal the modern payola system, and Yetnikoff is kind of the bad guy in that, or a bad, not even the really the worst bad guy, but he's kind of complicit along with the people that are the principal villains in that tale of basically indie promoters who locked independent records out of American radio in the late 70s to today. I mean, you still can't hear anything surprising on the radio, and it's because of the system. We won't get into that too much, but interestingly, there was a guy named Dick Asher who was his sort of, they were like co-presidents there for a little bit after the recession of 79. And for a few years, Yetnikoff and Asher were working together. And Asher was a real by the book kind of guy who tried to get rid of this indie promotion system, which is not technically payola, but it's payola.
It's payola. Like, you pay a guy who an exorbitant amount of money to get your song on the radio. You don't ask how he does it.
Yep.
It just appears on the radio once you pay this amount of money. And my sources say that is very much still in practice, even though, you know, there's only a couple of conglomerates that are controlling most of the radio right now.
Yeah, and there's only three record labels essentially, and this was already cutting. I mean, enormous amounts of money were being spent on this. At one, Asher made allegations that it was up to a third of the profit margin of the record labels, which seems high, but it's big, big money. And it seems like the real function of it wasn't so much to get their records on the radio as to keep anybody who couldn't afford to play that game off of the radio. And it's been very effective.
Right. That.
But let's dive into the book, though. This book was published after his run at CBS had ended. And unlike, say, Clive Davis, who was his mentor, who was fired from CBS for paying for his kid's bar mitzvah out of record company funds, allegedly. I still kind of think that was trumped up. But Clive Davis has obviously gone on to, you know, founded Arista and you know, had another 30 years still going in the music industry. And Davis, despite being a lawyer by training, he really did become a true record man in a way that Yetnikoff never did. But anyway, this book was published after Yetnikoff had fallen. And even though he started his own record label and tried to do a couple other things, none of that stuff ever really clicked. So his contribution was his years at CBS. So let's start with... Yeah, decades. Yes, indeed. Two decades, and he totally dominated. And so we're talking about Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen, Cyndi Lauper, Billy Joel.
Streisand.
Barbara Streisand, big figure. James Taylor, Paul Simon, one of his big enemies. and Paul McCartney and Mick Jagger, who both of whom he signed to big expensive deals pretty late in their careers. I doubt CBS ever recouped on those two deals. So
yeah. Oh, it's
actually, you're right. I guarantee you they didn't.
they probably did, but those are probably more signings that, you know, you're enticing all these other bigger players that could actually make you money. you know, you're like, you want to be on the same label as Paul McCartney, or you want to go with, you know, this little other dinky label called Sub Pop or whatever, you know?
Yep. Yeah. There's definitely some method to the madness there. But I think as a rule, he was better at managing people who are already superstars than he was at cultivating talent. His biggest signings were definitely the Jacksons, which left Motown for Epic Records pretty early on in his tenure. But it's not like he signed Michael Jackson, qua Michael Jackson. Jackson, Michael developed as a solo artist under. But again, you can't knock him. I mean, that's as big as it gets, the Michael Jackson in the late 70s.
The absolute, it's probably the biggest it will ever get.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he seems to have been an honest enough broker that... the people who are already highly successful had, you know, if you're highly successful in the music business, that means you've been burned 100 times. And then you run into somebody that isn't going to burn you. And that's Yetnikoff. he's not going to completely screw you over.
Yeah. Yeah. He seems to have been beloved. And this whole thing with the monstrous music mogul, basically he deliberately created this outsized persona. He was a lawyer and a protege of Clive Davis. You know, Brooklyn College, Columbia Law School, very much a nose to the grindstone, you know, Jewish guy from his dad was a house painter, very similar to, you know, Jerry Wexler and his dad, the window washer. I mean, but he wasn't a music biz guy. He wasn't a record man. He was a law firm guy. And in order to make it as a record guy, he created this just outlandish persona, temper tantrums, cocaine, drinking, lots of sex, and, you know, sort of tried to live the rock and roll lifestyle in a way, and clearly pulled it off. I mean, he did it for 20 years. Pretty interesting strategy. But let's go ahead and hear our first song, and this is the Jacksons, Shake Your Body Down to the Ground.
Let's shout, shake your body down to the ground. Let's dance, let's shout, shake your body down to the ground. Let's dance, let's shout, shake your body down to the ground.
And that was the Jacksons with Shake Your Body Down to the Ground from the late 70s. And that was on their second album with Epic, Destiny, which I think starts the whole grandiose album title thing that Michael and the Jacksons got into.
Yeah. And I think it's probably it is the start of adult Michael Jackson becoming the phenomenon that he is today. That's a really, really strong album, actually.
Yeah, it really is. And the interesting thing is that their first album on Epic was produced by Gamblin' Huff, the legendary co-inventors of disco, I guess, of Philly International. Absolutely the safe choice. You know, that was the logical move to do with the Jacksons when you brought them over, because CBS had, other than Philly International, they were very weak in R&B. And, you know, that album didn't click. So Yetnikoff actually let a very young Michael Jackson, and his brothers as well, but we all know Michael was in the driver's seat. Michael produced and wrote multiple songs, produced the whole album and with his brothers, and then wrote several songs on the album. So, yeah, that's a key decision that I think Yetnikoff can take credit for and deserves credit for. But let's get into the story a little bit more. Yeah. The book starts with this sort of ridiculous story of him meeting with Jackie Onassis, who is, of course, the widow of President John F. Kennedy, and Aristotle Onassis, the shipping magnate and billionaire. By this point, Jackie O was single and was working in the publishing business. I have no reason to doubt this story, that she wanted to sign Yetnikoff to a publishing deal. The book was published. I assume that speaks for itself. But there's, you know, just a number of lurid fantasies about him having sex with Jackie O that are pretty silly. And then he tells a story about, you know, interacting with Michael Jackson, which is something that he talks about quite a bit in the book. And he talks about how Michael Jackson used him to turn down David Geffen, who wanted a Michael Jackson song on the Days of Thunder soundtrack. Days of Thunder was one of those Simpson-Bruckheimer movies that came after Top Gun. And Michael didn't want to have a song on the soundtrack, but Michael wasn't the kind of guy who could say no, especially to somebody like David Geffen, who was incredibly persistent and persuasive. So Yetnikoff had to come in and do that. And that comes back to bite him in the ass at the end of the book. So there's some strategy there, but it also talks about dealing with Mick Jagger, who wants to know the promo budget for the Steel Wheels tour and wants him to spend more time with Keith Richards. talks about Tommy Mottola, who was his protege, who later replaced him at CBS. And according to Yetnikoff, after, you know, planting a big knife in his back, also has a phone call with Billy Joel, who's calling to thank him, like you said, for warning about his management and encourage him to audit them. And then he talks about his other big partners, which Japanese guys, Oga and Morita, who were the executives at Sony who famously bought CBS. And according to Yetnikoff's telling, he's the guy who brokered that whole deal because he had been in on the CBS-Sony partnership. He had helped negotiate it all the way back in the 60s, long before he was the king of the thing. So what was your take on him just from that first early chapter?
I guess my take on him was this guy love to be and thrive maybe in being in these high pressure situations at like the height of the music industry. You know, the Jackie O thing seemed to be a way of illustrating that. I mean, he was completely delusional and, you know, drug addled and drunk and all this, but somehow he was able to function and maintain himself and be able to, you know, pull through on all these different things, all these various strings that were pulling him in different directions. And you know, he eventually, you know, spoiler alert, he, you know, goes through recovery. But before he does that, you kind of see that somehow this guy's still doing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, to believe his telling of it, he's doing Herculean amounts of cocaine and plenty of pot and plenty of booze to go with it. But let's go back to his story. So he's born in 1933, Jewish family in Brooklyn, like I said, son of a painter and window washer. And, you know, has a dramatic story about his pop having a standoff with his uncle Max over something that his mother had done. His pop was defending his mother, although they didn't have the best relationship. The mother cuckolded him multiple times. It's very similar to the Jerry Wexler story, in fact, about their parental relationship. But father was pretty abusive with Yetnikoff, or at the very least very firm with Yetnikoff, and they weren't close. But his dad had a heart attack right in the middle of that violent confrontation with Uncle Max. So that's kind of the human interest element there. But he's just an incredibly bright student. He aces Brooklyn College, makes it to Columbia Law School, navigates the difficulty of being a Jewish kid at Columbia Law School at a time when that wasn't all that common. Then he's in the Army for a little while and then comes out and joins up with Rosamond Colin K. Petchick and Freund. I'm sure I'm butchering multiple of those names, but that's where he meets Clive Davis. And Clive Davis is the Pied Piper who leads him into the music biz. So anything to add to his background?
I mean, one thing that I can say is that I think it's pretty significant that his background is so completely unmusical.
Yes.
Compared with, you know, who we were just talking about.
Wexler. Yeah.
Wexler. Yeah. You know, music was just his life. But this is sort of Yetnikoff and Clive Davis sort of represent the beginning of the lawyers coming in. As far as Clive is concerned, in creative ways. But this is the beginning of real big business.
Yeah, this is where the business comes over and takes him on. And so let's do a little history of CBS Records, because they work together at the firm. Clive Davis gets recruited to go over to CBS, and eventually he pulls Yetnikoff in with him. And when they sign on in 62, when Yetnikoff signed on with CBS, Goddard Lieberson was the president of CBS. This is a legendary figure. I mean, literally a guy who hung out with the Kennedys, who once had a lunch meeting with Jackie Onassis and turns into a sex fantasy in his autobiography. Lieberson actually hung out at the White House and all their other mansions and floated in that environment. And Bill Paley, who was the owner of the bigger CBS conglomeration that included the radio and the TV network and everything, you know, and built the BlackRock empire, he was a Jewish guy, but he loves these waspy guys. And Lieberson was somehow kind of both, you know, like just very much fit in that world of a waspdom, but at the same time could navigate it. And CBS was built on things like the My Fair Lady soundtrack. Lieberson even funded the play, broke Leonard Bernstein, made him a, you know, massive cultural figure in the U.S., hired Mitch Miller, who, you know, ran the A&R in the 50s and is responsible for How Much Is That Doggy in the Window and Mule Train. And, you know, this very powerful figure, kind of the greatest A&R man of all time, but also kind of one of the worst. Frank Sinatra hated him, blamed him for, you know, his career problems, and did not click with Mitch Miller. Mitch Miller was very anti-rock and roll. So CBS was way behind the other major labels in rock and roll. Like RCA had Elvis, Capitol Records got the Beatles by the 60s. But in 62, CBS didn't really have a rock and roll wing. And, you know, Clive Davis climbs up the ladder. He's administrative VP by 1965 and president by 1967. And then let's take a quick break and hear our next song. And this is Bruce Springsteen's Atlantic City from his Nebraska album. Blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're getting ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no rumble out on the promenade, and the gambling commission's hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Well, now everything dies, baby, that's a fact. That was Atlantic City from Nebraska by Bruce Springsteen. And this is another one where Yetnikoff gives himself credit and probably deserves it for letting Springsteen release Nebraska, which is basically him on acoustic guitar. No E Street Band. You know, it's coming after the river. He's big, but he's not as big as he's going to get. And most record companies probably would not have backed that play. But Yetnikoff had confidence in Springsteen, let him put out what everybody knew was going to be a non-commercial album, and gets his reward with Born in the USA as the follow-up and then the live album. So, and I really am a big believer in the theory that an excellent record, even if it doesn't sell well initially, lays the groundwork for bigger sales down the road. Just like a weak record that sells a whole lot can kill your career, can kill an artist's career if it gets overexposed. So I would say that Nebraska was a key part of Born in the USA being such a hotly anticipated album.
Yeah, it's called artist development. I mean, it's something that used to happen a lot more in that period and before. But, you know, there, you can just look at the album lists of various artists that didn't hit until maybe the fifth album. And, you know, there's still money and promotion being pumped into them. Nowadays, it's just not like that at all.
Yeah, they won't even let an established artist release a single until it's a hit on TikTok. So, you know, but this is a period when they're still doing some of that artist development, although we'll talk about some artists that he wasn't as helpful with in a little bit. But back to sort of the history of CBS. And so Clive Davis takes over in 67, goes to Monterey, and I don't know if he literally dropped acid or not, but he has this revelation. I doubt he dropped acid. Joe Smith dropped acid when he was signing the Grateful Dead to Warner Brothers, but non-consensually. But I don't know about Clive doing that. But Clive has this revelation, signs Big Brother and the Holding Company, Electric Flag with Michael Bloomfield, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the Chambers Brothers, even signed Scott McKenzie before the thing, who had the hit single San Francisco that was written by Papa John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, who had masterminded the Monterey Pop thing. But so CBS makes this hard turn into rock and roll, perfectly timed. Janis Joplin was the star of the festival. Clive Sinzer with Big Brother and the Holding Company. She was in a band at that time, doesn't go solo till a little later. But, you know, those are smart moves by Clive Davis, although he also completely destroyed Moby Grape, who was the hottest band coming out of San Francisco as of Monterey. And that the CBS literally released five singles on them at the same time. And Ahmet Ertegun in his autobiography claims that he tricked Clive Davis into doing that by talking about how they're the next Beatles. And you know, the way the Beatles had five hit singles in the top 10 at the same time, I think Moby Grape can do that also. And yeah. And so, but anyway,
I think it's Moby Grape. Moby Grape was really good, but not in that environment. You're not.
No, the Beatles was a unique phenomenon. And even the Beatles, had they been signed in a different time and place, could not have done that. But anyway, Davis establishes himself as a true record man and has a great run at CBS up until 1973, when he sacked for misappropriation of funds, which was probably overblown. And one of the factors that they talk about too is CBS, of course, owned 60 Minutes, the investigative news magazine, and had to worry about their licenses from the FDA, not FDA, the FCC, to put on TV shows and radio shows. This was much more serious. Like back in the day, before the Fairness Doctrine and things were stripped away, before we were in our modern neoliberal era, the networks were actually pretty closely regulated. And so CBS had to be careful like that. So any kind of hint of impropriety and the other branches of CBS freaked out. So Davis gets pushed out, which accidentally killed Stax Records. And that doesn't come up here. But that leaves our boy Yetnikoff with his big opportunity to come through and become the president. And another figure that comes up in the book a lot I haven't talked about is the infamous Morris Levy, who is the villain of Hitman, who's the villain of the Frankie Lyman story and has a character on The Sopranos that was based on him. Morris Levy is like the face of mafia infiltration of the music biz in the 20th century. And Yetnikoff's What did you make of Yetnikoff's telling of his relationship with Morris Levy?
Yetnikoff seemed to like him quite a bit. They you know, had a fairly chummy relationship, even though it seems like he screwed him out of a horse race or something.
Yeah, he got Yetnikoff to invest $300,000 in a horse that never paid out. Barely got the $300,000 back over many years. But there's various altercations like that. The first time he meets him, though, he's sent there to collect $400,000 that Morris Levy owes CBS, and that was a big test for Yetnikoff, because that's the kind of thing nobody wants to do. Morris Levy's a great big dude who's literally an associate of the Genovese family back when, it's still scary, but back then it was really, really scary. And Yetnikoff claims that he came out of that meeting with the 400, and got a check for $400,000 delivered to CBS within a couple days. So yeah, it's fascinating. And I think because Hitman had come out and had linked him so tightly with Morris Levy, he had to address that. But he doesn't, and he does address the indie promoter thing also, but never quite as direct. I think it's very artfully done. And I think David Ritz did a really good job of helping him structure this book so that it's a PR positive for him.
Yeah, for sure. And the way that Yetnikoff paints it and that David Ritz paints it, he comes off as somebody who knew that improper things were going on, but those improper things were necessary for the business and for him to do well in his job. That's what he says. I'm sure, that's what so many powerful people say, that we have to keep these things in place or else we'll go under. It's very rare that, these businesses you know, just take it to the corrupt institutions. Why? We're making money this way.
Yeah. The one thing, though, the way Yetnikoff describes his particular tactic of dealing with Levy is that he approaches it as just a very by the book thing. When he wanted the 400 grand, he just said, hey, I'm here to get the 400 grand, basically. And, you know, when there were various confrontations, there's another time when he, you know, filed suit against Levy over, I can't remember which conflict it was, but I have seen that
the
work.
ELO issue.
Yes, Levy had gotten a hold of an enormous number of illegal ELO albums, of cutouts that were not on the books, and was selling them in England, almost a million records that, quote, fell off the truck, and then Levy's taken them over to England. That was, you know, one took over the line, sweet Jesus, so Yetnikoff sued him. But let's take a break from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about more of Walter Yetnikoff's misadventures in the music biz. So, yeah, I was talking about this tactic that Yetnikoff claims he used to deal with Morris Levy, and it's one I've seen work, where if you're an official and you've got a job to do and you strictly buy the book and you insist on sticking to that, then you can deal with all kinds of unsavory people and powerful people in an honorable way. And that's to me, that kind of has the ring of truth to it. And then there's a couple of other big accomplishments that Yetnikoff trumpets, and I think these are also to his credit. That, you know, a big part of the break for Thriller, which, you know, Jack, like we talked about the Jacksons, the beginning of adult Michael Jackson, and then he wants to do a solo album. So in 1979, Off the Wall comes out, and Yetnikoff says he greenlighted that, and obviously he did, especially because Quincy Jones was going to be the producer. And if you know Quincy Jones' history of working with Frank Sinatra and then a pop producer in the 60s with Leslie Gore and others, and arranger, soundtrack artist, just absolutely A-list guy. Any music biz insider would respect Quincy Jones at that time. And so that seemed like a lock to Yetnikoff, and probably would have seemed like a lock to virtually any music executive at that point. But, you know, very smart move. Off the Wall sells millions, establishes Michael Jackson as an adult solo act. And probably the only great disco album CBS ever put out on their own label. I'm talking out of my ass there. I have to double check that. But it's the only disco album I can think of.
Another. Maybe Dr. Buzzard's originals Vanna Band might have been on Columbia. I don't know. It feels like a Columbia sign.
Yeah, that could be. That could be. But the key thing was, when the follow-up is due to come out in 82, MTV is suddenly a factor, which it had not been in 79. And MTV was segregated. It was all white. And Yetnikoff is the guy who forced them to break that. He threatened to pull all of CBS's videos from MTV, and he had already played hardball with MTV by forcing them to pay the record companies to get the videos, rather than seeing it as promotion along with radio. And because it was unregulated, the FCC was not taking an interest in this. They are able to cut that deal, and I think forcing MTV to pay was very smart on Yetnikoff's part. Although in the end, I think that kind of killed the music video as a viable thing around the 2000s. That was one of the factors that made it hard for MTV. Just made more money doing other things than playing music videos, in part because they had to pay for the music videos. But nonetheless, the important thing is that he bullied them into playing Michael Jackson videos. And lo and behold, all of the kids in America wanted to see Michael Jackson on MTV. It was so good for MTV. MTV should have been thanking him, because, you know, no Michael Jackson, no MTV as we know it. I mean, it just wouldn't have been the same at all. The cultural impact of that move, can that be overstated? I mean, that is a really big deal.
No, I don't think so, especially since there were, you know, people in rural areas that were sort of being turned onto pop music more and more, especially like these discos were, you know, cropping up in the Midwest and stuff like that. But, you know, there's not, you know, the OJs aren't coming through Iowa or wherever too much. So, the exposure to Black musicians just isn't there until this happens. And that's, if I'm correct, that's a lot of the base of MTV was like these rural areas where they never got great television reception in the first place. So they get cable. And here's MTV as a part of the cable package. And so you're seeing a lot of Kaja Gugu and stuff like that.
And that's what made the record industry pay attention to MTV in the first place, was like, suddenly Kaja Gugu is selling albums in Laramie, Wyoming. And people are like, what? You know, and the Human League and Duran Duran and so many groups like that. And then once Black artists get a chance, and of course, we should mention Rick James.
Yes.
Who was
that's
on Motown.
Exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah, and had spoken out vociferously against this racism, but he didn't have the kind of muscle, and Motown definitely didn't have the muscle as an independent label at that time to, you know, muscle MTV into playing it. And in fact, Rick James was basically permanently banned from MTV for speaking out on that. Never did get exposure on MTV. But nonetheless, Yetnikoff solved that problem.
Yeah, it was Michael Jackson and that sort of opened the door for Prince, and every now and again there would be somebody else, but until TV Raps, they were kind of it, but it was still huge. Like, this is the era that I grew up in. I grew up in probably the first era where the biggest selling artist of that time was, you know, a Black artist, and the biggest selling albums artist of all time was this Black artist, Michael Jackson. It was that's just something that my grandmother, who grew up, in the 20s, just couldn't say that the biggest selling jazz artist was Louis Armstrong. It wasn't.
No, it was Bing Crosby and Paul Whiteman and so many others. And that pattern repeated through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And another factor is Rolling Stone magazine would not feature R&B artists on the cover. And I remember talking to Ed Ward about this. Jan Winter's story was, you know, R&B doesn't sell. As far as I can tell, they put Sun Ra on the cover very early on, and that didn't sell as well. And, you know, I love Sun Ra. Massive cultural impact, but not somebody you're going to peg. You know, avant-garde jazz is not going to be getting the issues to fly off the shelves. And I'm sure in the early 70s, it was also a very racist time, racist backlash. Rock and funk are separating. Mostly because of segregation on FM radio, but I do think there was an element of Black nationalism coming up, and, you know, a white backlash to the civil rights movement. So you know, both communities, I think, were kind of pulling back on their own, but definitely the big corporate segregation and racism was the biggest factor in that. And so Yetnikoff bullied Jan Winter into putting Michael Jackson on the cover of Rolling Stone. And I'm sure that made Jan Winter a lot of money and, you know, opened his eyes to a new era being out. So those are the positives on Yetnikoff, but there's a few things he didn't mention. And let's hear our next song and then we'll talk about those. And this is Cyndi Lauper's All Through the Night. And that was Cyndi Lauper's All Through the Night. And Cyndi Lauper, I would have to say, is one of the artists that Yetnikoff signed and developed. So, you know, definitely a feather in his cap there. Although another key artist that he signed that made a ton of money for CBS, he doesn't mention at all, is Weird Al Yankovic. Why not love for Weird Al?
You know, I couldn't tell you because I love Weird Al myself. And he's definitely got a corner of the music business that nobody else has really probably tried to touch.
Yeah, absolutely unique artist. The only novelty record career, the only multi-decade novelty record career in history as far as
probably.
I know.
Yeah.
And, you know, hands down. And worked so well with them having Michael Jackson. Obviously, the Beat It and Eat It parody was classic. But, you know, I can see, I mean, why are you going to mention Weird Al Yankovic when you've got, you know, all these other Barbra Streisand and Mick Jagger to tell? But another artist that he doesn't mention at all is The Clash. And I had forgotten about The Clash's difficulties with CBS until you reminded me. So, you know, first off, The Clash's first album comes out in 1977 in England, and it was CBS England that signed him to what was then considered just a scandalous, I mean, the punk rock community was very scandalized by The Clash signing with CBS. This is in the aftermath of the Sex Pistols various label signings and droppings and the great rock and roll swindle, as Malcolm McLaren called it. But CBS USA would not release The Clash's first album in the States. They flat out would not put it out. It wasn't not just that they wouldn't promote it. They would not release it until 1979. In the intervening year of 1978, that's the biggest import album in the country. So that was a boneheaded mistake. I think it sold like 100,000 copies as an import. Might have been only 20,000. I've seen different figures. But either way, clearly there was a market, if not a massive market, but there was a market for The Clash in 1977.
For sure. I think labels like Columbia, you know, they talk about like Motown being squeaky clean, but no, not like Columbia. Columbia, you know, they've got artists who are, you know, fantastic. You know, James Taylor is great and Paul Simon is great. The Jacksons are great, but there's a certain slickness that I could see reading about the Clash signing with CBS and just scratching your head like, how is this going to go? Did we just lose them already?
That was the consensus at the time.
Which they didn't. I think what I've heard, I can't remember if it was the London Calling album, which was a double album, or the Sandinista album, which was a triple album, triple LP. But I believe that the Clash just like held the master tapes, sort of stole the master tapes and kept them away until CBS agreed to sell them for the price of one LP, which is just, you know, that's not something that Yetnikoff probably wants to talk about.
Yeah, and I think my understanding of this, and I should have brushed up on this more before this episode, but that I remember London Calling did not have a double fold gate. Like, you know, Sgt. Pepper's and all these albums in the 70s, basically even single albums would have a double gatefold sleeve. So it opened up like a book and you could roll your doobies and all that stuff in the fold. And there were so many double albums that came out in the 70s. They all had gatefold sleeves. And London Calling was both records stuffed into one sleeve, which I'd never seen before. And there was also something else in their contract where London Calling counted as two albums for the purposes of their contract. Like they had an 8-record deal or a 14-record deal, whatever it was, they were knocking out two at once. And then they come back with Sandinista and want to do a triple album. And London Calling had been their commercial breakthrough. They had a hit single, Train in Vain. London Calling had made the top 30 or something like that, but they were not platinum artists or well-established, but they were getting radio play. They were selling. It was obvious they were going places. Then they show up with Sandinista, which is this triple album filled with all kinds of experiments. It's like somebody said, you know, London Calling proved that The Clash could do anything, and Sandinista's, they try to do everything.
it's the sound of them going in a thousand directions at once.
Yeah, and you know,
yeah, it's kind of their white album, sort of.
On Beyond, if the White Album had included, you know, What's the New Mary Jane and every outtake, you know, that it could have and been a triple album, that would have been Sandinista. Sandinista, to me, boils down to be a really great single album and a pretty solid double album, but the triple album is just full of filler. Anyway, and so I can see
the experience.
Yeah, Yetnikov having troubles with that. And like you say, The Clash is really the only contemporary hard rock band that I can think of that made a major impact that was on CBS at that point in time. Although he does partner with Def Jam, and again doesn't mention it except to mention that the Public Enemy Professor Griff kerfuffle when Griff made some anti-Semitic remarks and had to be kicked out of the band and the group. You know, every band has like a career arc, or every act has a career arc. And that was kind of the peak of Public Enemy's career arc. Once they had that trouble with Professor Griff, they never quite recovered the momentum they had. And he mentions that in the context of that, but doesn't talk about the Def Jam deal at all, which was a really big deal.
Yeah, how about that? Yeah.
And I assume that was something probably Tommy Mottola or somebody else under him took care of. But nonetheless, yeah, it's interesting to me that he wasn't focused on that. And frankly, his job was to be on the phone with the Paul Simon. And that's the other thing we mentioned. And he does talk about the Paul Simon feud. But essentially, as soon as he gets to the label or ascends to the presidency of the label, gets crossways with Paul Simon, just does not like the guy. And they have this brutal falling out. And ends up, Paul Simon goes to Warner Brothers at the same time that he poaches James Taylor away from Warner Brothers. And that kind of brings us to his F the Bunny campaign. And basically, Warner Brothers was the top label. And I did an episode with Peter Ames Carlin about his book Sonic Boom about Warner Brothers. And Mo Austin was kind of the king record man of this era. And also you had Joe Smith there. And then they had Atlantic with Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler. So the Warner Elektra Atlantic conglomerate, and David Geffen was in there as well with his Asylum label. They were the top label. That was the label all the artists wanted to be on. They were selling the most records. And so Yetnikov very shrewdly picks them and you know, says, these are the guys I want to take out. And he does things like poach James Taylor away from him. And Taylor does go on to have another couple hits for him, but his biggest hits were behind him. And he lets Paul Simon go, seemingly at a really smart time, because the next couple albums Paul Simon does struggle. He ends up, you know, trying to get back with Art Garfunkel, and they have a very successful Central Park concert, but then they can't do the follow-up album. Of course, then he triumphs with Graceland. Yetnikov doesn't mention that.
Why would he?
Yeah. But he does mention signing Elvis Costello, and he gives Lisa Robinson, the pioneering rock critic, female rock critic, credit for tipping him off to that. He pairs Barbara Streisand with Barry Gibb for their hit Guilty. And Barry Gibb was with RSO, which was Robert Stigwood's label. Stigwood obviously had massive success with Grease and the Saturday Night Live soundtrack, and of course, Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. And Barry Gibb was, you know, the key songwriter and producer in much of that. So it's pretty slick on Yetnikov's part to get Streisand with Barry Gibb. And I want to run a theory past you that Barry Gibb's partnership with Barbara Streisand is the beginning of modern pop as we know it today, that all the Whitney Houstons and, you know, everything that comes after that comes from this album, that before this, Barbara Streisand was in this Broadway pocket that never really figured out how to deal with rock. Like at one point she did a rock and roll album, but it wasn't a massive hit. And I don't think her identity was really stable until she did that partnership with Barry Gibb. But let's hear our last song. And this is The Clash, Ivan Meets G.I. Joe from the Sandinista album.
He tried his tricks, that rusty bear. He united
And that was The Clash with Ivan Meets G.I. Joe from Sandinista. So, Brooks, what do you think of my theory? Is that as epic as I'm making it out to be?
I think it could be that. We're floating around that era where it's starting to change, where you're getting like the pairing of a super producer with an established star. We just talked about a pairing that was happening around the same time, which was Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones. So but between those two, and maybe Donna Summer wasn't huge before she was with Giorgio Moroder, but that pairing probably helped things along quite a bit too. Like,
that's a good point. And also Lionel Richie's partnerships and crossovers with Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton in that same era. But Barry Gibb was mixed up in that too. He was collaborating with those same artists. So I think there's something going on there, but it's right in this era when what we would now call modern pop, all the names I can't think of.
Yeah.
All the acts my daughter makes me listen to, all sprang from that. The Keishas and Taylor Swift and.
Yeah, I'm thinking of everybody from Janet Jackson to Lorde who are these people? We know who these people are.
We're old and we're dudes. It's not our thing. But anyway, I think you're right to include Michael Jackson in that and Janet in that nexus as well. But anyway, we got to get to the fall of Walter Yetnikoff now. And so in the 80s, there was a thing called the hostile takeover. And this is the beginning of the era when stock markets are just unfettered. It's like they hadn't been since the great crash in 1929. And so people like Ted Turner and Marvin Davis and Ivan Boesky are corporate raiders. And they are pulling these stunts that, financial shenanigans, basically, that would give them leverage over a corporation. And tons of corporations were taken over in these leveraged buyouts where people were manipulating junk bonds. This is where the whole formula of I'm going to borrow a gazillion dollars, I'm going to buy a company, I'm going to saddle that company with all this debt I just accumulated, I'm going to loot the company, and then I'm going to stick them with the debt and send the shareholders holding the bag down the road. And so Bill Paley and everybody at CBS did not want CBS to fall into fate like that. And so they sell to Larry Tisch, who buys it in 86, and by 87, he's selling CBS Music to Sony. And Yetnikoff, who had put together that deal in the 60s and stayed very close with the key executives at Sony, negotiated that deal. And this, to me, is a classic case of kind of the dog catching the car. Because Yetnikoff thought, since he was so tight with the key executives at Sony, and that he was just locked in, and he made sure those executives personally profited enormously from it. He profited enormously from it, but he literally thought he was then going to go to Hollywood and negotiate deals for Sony to buy studios. He did do some negotiating. None of those deals ever come through. And the net effect of it is within a few years, he's forced out. And it's this vicious combination of Alan Grubman, who was a guy that was pals with Tommy Mottola and sort of a factotum to Yetnikoff, and somebody that Yetnikoff abused all through the book. He tells about all that, get down and bark like a dog, Alan, or do this or do that. But Yetnikoff and Mottola would get Grubman to become the lawyers of various clients. But then Grubman kind of turns on him. And when he becomes Michael Jackson's lawyer, that's kind of a death blow, or one of several it's a warning blow that Yetnikoff should have heeded. And then a specific Japanese executive, Oga, whose first name I didn't write down, apologies for that. But he's the guy that Yetnikoff claims that he made sure profited handsomely in this period. And then they were never as close as they had been before. This is a guy I'd known for decades who'd stayed at his house. They, you know, told each other all their secrets. And there's an old expression, you know, don't do people big favors because they'll never forgive you for it. And I think I think this is one of those cases where the guy owed Walter and didn't want it and paid him back, you know, with a big knife in the back. And so he's forced out. His protege, Tommy Mottola, was actually in the office next door negotiating his deal to take over the company. As this was happening. So, you know, for any sins Yetnikoff committed, he gets his payback at his downfall. Is it, what do you think? Like, I don't know. I score it fairly even for Yetnikoff. He accomplished, he did some, you know, getting Michael Jackson on MTV alone is worth a great deal. But negotiating this ripoff of artist royalties so that they got half as many royalties on CDs as they got on vinyl is a massive demerit, you know? Like, I don't know. Where do you come down on Yetnikoff's overall contribution?
Oh, you know, I think somebody like Yetnikoff is not from the standpoint of like a Jerry Wexler. He's not Jerry Wexler. We can't really thank him too much for, you know, propelling artistry or anything like that. But he's an interesting figure and a key figure in this turning point, right? Where it really becomes a business. The music business really, it's very hard to wrestle music into being a business. It's sort of incompatible, but
yeah, I mean, I would call our modern era kind of the blind idiot god era of the music business, where they literally have no idea what they're doing and then constantly step in on their babies without even noticing, you know, what they're doing, to the point where, you know, music has lost its grip on popular culture, you know, compared with like what it was like when we were growing up, much less the 1960s. Music is far from the hippest or most influential art form today. And I think this is the moment where it really starts. I think if Clive Davis had not been fired from CBS in 73 and had stayed on through the 70s and 80s, and he might have been able to hold on to the 90s, you never know. He's an arrogant guy, supposedly, a lot of people don't like, but he was a true record man, despite not having the resume for it. And, you know, you can argue about his taste and whether or not he, you know, spoiled Aretha Franklin's later career, or whether he, you know, some people consider Whitney Houston's career to have been a waste. I don't personally view Whitney Houston that way. I mean, just from seeing what she has meant to, her work has meant to so many people.
I can't take that take, no.
Yeah, no, but I can understand why some people are frustrated that she didn't do this or she didn't do that. She is, again, one of those artists who could have done anything. And, you know, so she's not going to be remembered in the same way as, say, Sarah Vaughan or somebody, or even Aretha Franklin. You know, she didn't ascend to those heights, but she certainly achieved a lot. But anyway, I think if Davis had stayed at CBS with Yetnikoff as his right-hand man, this era we're in now wouldn't have started quite as quickly, that it was more analogous to what Mo Austin or Ahmet Erdogan or other record men were doing at other labels. But either way, by the early 90s, when Yetnikoff gets pushed out, that's when the record industry really starts self-sabotaging. We already talked about this with the guy who replaced Mo Austin. I talked about this with Peter Ames Carlin, that, you know, they immediately bring in somebody who's immediately doing things like pissing off Eric Clapton. And at a point when Eric Clapton really was selling a ton of records and mattered. I'm hoping to do future episodes on what happened to the business in the 90s and 2000s, but none of it's good. And Yetnikoff is this key pivotal figure where it transitions from record men. And I would be saying record women, but there just frankly weren't that many of them. It was a very sexist industry and business. But the people that come after Yetnikoff are, with some exceptions, but for the most part, just not at all engaged with the product they're creating or the people who create the product that they're selling. They're not creating anything, but the product that they're selling, you know.
Yeah. You know, I was, as I was reading the book, it made me think so much about something that Frank Zappa had said a bunch of different times about record executives. And I actually looked it up, and it made me think a little differently than I had been thinking about Yetnikoff. Frank Zappa was basically saying that, you know, in the olden days of the record industry, there was, you know, some bald cigar chomping man who didn't know what the hell was going on, but these kids were coming up to him and, you know, they had a thing and it seemed to be going well in their community. And he's like, yeah, I don't know what this is, but put it out. And he says that that was better than the, you know, the hippies that got in there and matured out of the revolution a little bit, who said, we know what the kids want and it's not this, you know, give us something else. And Yetnikoff was kind of more in the latter.
He's kind of the next wave after that crop, because you could kind of put Mo Austin, Joe Smith, Clive Davis in that category. But again, Zappa's kind of wrong there, because you also had people like Ertegun and Wexler who were down in there writing songs for the, you know, artists and stuff. But yeah, I know what you mean there. But go ahead and let you finish.
Yeah. People like Ertegun and Wexler, and certainly Berry Gordy, those people are very hands on. But Yetnikoff never claims to really have a strong connection to the music at all. Like it never wants to. I think a big thing about the record industry, like from a little bit after or during his time on, is that you get all these people who really think that they know what's going to sell, what's going to hit. And I think the one thing that we as pop music historians can say is that, no, you don't.
Yeah,
you don't know what the next big thing is going to be. You don't know. You know, there are so many stories of these artists that executive think are terrible, and then they just like become these incredibly influential, sometimes successful acts. But these days the record industry is filled with people who really have fooled themselves into thinking they know what they're doing. Yeah. And I think Frank Zappa's point is that the old guys always kind of knew it was a crapshoot. Well, but you know, they were gambling on their gut. Well, Yetnikoff doesn't think he knows what the best music is, but he doesn't really have a gut either. So he's just going with what's in the contracts. And, you know, once his A&R people bring these folks in, for the most part, or he's already dealing with an established artist like Rolling Stones or the Jacksons or something like that, then he can look at the contracts and see like what sort of promotional things they want to do, what sort of promotional things they don't want to do. And he can make them feel very comfortable. And that's a skill. It's a skill to make an artist feel comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was clearly very good at that. So that's our discussion of Howling at the Moon, The Odyssey of a Monstrous Music Mogul in an Age of Excess by Walter Yetnikoff with David Ritz. So Brooks, and my guest has been Brooks Long, continuing our series of David Ritz books. So we've got a few interesting choices to come up next. What do you want to do next? So there's Grandmaster Flash. There's Rick James. There's Jimmy Scott. The Neville Brothers.
I think I'm looking on my shelf and I've got Glow, the Rick James book.
Yep. Let's do it. Rick James next time. Brooks, always a pleasure. Thanks.
Always.
On.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate welcomes Eric Weisbard to discuss his book, Songbooks, The Literature of American Popular Music. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.